Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so say the state is deciding who should receive a 20-year, multi-billion-dollar clean energy contract. Should the people helping pick the proposal also get to submit a bid? Well, environmental advocates and trade groups say no, but state officials, they didn't seem to mind when last week they chose the Northern Pass Project, a venture between Eversource Energy and Hydro-Québec, despite Eversource's role in helping write the bidding rules and its role in picking the winners. Well, Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Matthew Beaton says that state law mandated the participation of Eversource and other utilities in the selection process because of their expertise in crafting these types of complex proposals. But others are calling for more transparency. Today, Attorney General Maura Healey announced she will be conducting a review of the administration's selection process. Now, we invited the Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary and the Department of Energy Resources Commissioner Judith Judson and Matthew Beaton as well, Secretary Beaton, on today. They both declined. We're going to hear from Eversource in a minute, but first let's talk about why so many people are upset about this. Joining us is Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry. She's president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
So what's the problem here?
Meghna, we're really disappointed by this. It appears to be one of the most environmentally intrusive projects of the 40, that's 40, projects that were submitted. And it's also clearly not the cheapest. You know, from the beginning, the lack of transparency in this process has been really troubling. As you said, Eversource co-wrote the RFP and the legislation that preceded it. They were a bidder, and they were on the selection committee that selected their own project. How many seats at the table do you get?
Well, so to that point, though, I mean, as I said, Secretary Beaton has said these are such unique types of projects and they're so complicated that the state felt that they needed the expertise of utilities who were in this field in order to help guide them. I mean, how many other groups beyond a company like Eversource have that kind of expertise?
And I think that's fair. I will just... You know, I think the core of what troubles ELM and troubles so many other advocates is that public information about this has always been really limited. To give you an example, ELM and our partners drafted these four principles that should guide the utilities in the state in this process. And I'll just summarize them so you can get a sense for how Northern Pass seems to fit none of those principles. First, we wanted a successful, what we call 83D project must provide clean energy with the least overall impact to the environment. Northern Pass has 192 miles of transmission and much through national parklands and pristine landscapes that are just beloved by all kinds of people.
It's had significant pushback from those folks in the White Mountains especially.
The community opposition has been vociferous. You know, just briefly, the other three principles, we were calling for new incremental generation, but this project is all hydro. A successful project could ideally spur new wind and solar, but this just siphons existing resources. We said third that ideally projects would provide power soon. Northern Pass says it's shovel ready, but it's missing some key permits, two in particular of which are likely to be loudly appealed if they're granted. So there's real project risk here too.
Yeah.
And then last is that, and probably most important, is that we wanted ratepayers to get value for their investment. This clearly is not the cheapest by a long shot, and the administration has even said so. In recent weeks, other projects have hinted at their costs. One even claims to be about half the price. So if this is multi-billion dollars, then what are ratepayers getting?
Well, this is really interesting to me because this project ostensibly could fulfill between, 15 to 20%
That's
of
right.
the state's electricity needs. It's a huge amount. But at the risk of putting words in your mouth and push back on me and tell me if I'm off base here. I still am sort of hung up on this. Utilities help get to pick the project that they get to bid on part. I mean, is it too much for me to say that a simpler way of putting it, if you were going to be truly critical, is saying, why are you handing a state decision over to these major corporations?
I mean, I think that's a fair question. Eversource has a huge role to play in the state, right? They help keep the lights on. They provide power to millions of customers, and I don't want to undersell that. I do think, however, that they have a tremendous amount of influence at the State House and in Beacon Hill, and that it's the role of advocates and the public to really be constantly questioning that. You know, I'm relatively new to the State House and Massachusetts politics, as you know, but I have been sobered by their power and influence. We did a quick scan of the lobbyist filings, for example. The last 3 years, they've spent $750,000 in lobbying, in direct lobbying expenses. They have $40,000 in direct contributions to Baker and Polito just recently. And we didn't haven't even gotten into the PAC or the super PAC expenditures yet. So there's a lot of money on the line. And maybe it's all above board, but we're going to need some more information.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry, president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Megan.
Well, let's turn now then to the people behind Northern Pass. Joining us is Bill Quinlan, president of Eversource New Hampshire. He's been very involved in the development of the Northern Pass project, and he joins us now. Mr. Quinlan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Good afternoon.
Very appreciative that you join us today. You heard what Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry said, and I sort of underscored it perhaps in more stark language here. But do you think that Eversource has had an unfair number of seats at the table in making this decision?
Actually, I don't agree. No, I think as Secretary Beaton, I heard your conversation about Secretary Beaton, pointed out, I do think utilities possess unique expertise. And therefore, you know, my understanding of Massachusetts law is that they anticipated that and they provided for it. So on the one hand, you have the utility, Eversource in this case, who's expert in evaluating power supply and projects, and they're the portion of the company that is involved in the bid process. On the other hand, we have a separate company, which is called Northern Pass Transmission on our competitive side, and they are the project developer and bidder. There is a very strict standard of conduct in place between those two corporate entities that absolutely prohibits communications across that border. Secondly, you also have an independent evaluator, which is provided for specifically in Massachusetts law, on behalf of the state of Massachusetts, overseeing the entire bid evaluation process. And I think that should give us all comfort that this is a fair and transparent process.
But let me just jump in here if I could for a second, because the independent evaluator, that's a point well made and well taken. But about sort of Eversource versus the New Hampshire branch being completely separate entities, I still think that there are many people look at this and still see a fundamental conflict of interest, though, right? Because you can't say that these folks don't know each other or that the companies have no connection to each other, really, can you?
Well, you can in this instance. The standard of conduct, as I say, is very strict, and it prohibits expressly communications during this bid evaluation process. We take that very seriously at Eversource. We understand why those rules are important to ensure transparency, and they are strictly honored. And I do think the other thing that the statute provides for is involvement by the Attorney General in Massachusetts in both selecting the independent evaluator and working along with DOER in reviewing the outcome. So I do think we're getting the state and the independent entities within the state, they're involved in the process, as I understand it, and they will be confirming that this process was all above board and open.
Just so one last point, and,
sure.
and forgive me for pressing on this, but yeah. Doesn't everybody report to the same CEO, to Jim Judge?
Ultimately, they do report to the same CEO. But I don't think that changes our adherence in any way to the standard of conduct.
So what about this other issue of the significant pushback that Northern Pass has received from lots of residents, especially in northern New Hampshire, because of their concerns about the effects that all these transmission lines would have on their lives and on their property?
Yeah, I will say that, you know, in New Hampshire generally, there is very broad support around Northern Pass. We've spent a very long time listening to concerns raised by New Hampshire residents and business entities, and we've taken some very significant steps to address those. For example, I heard Elizabeth talk about going through the National Forest and with an overhead transmission line. Well, that is something we changed as a result of feedback from New Hampshire. We've placed 60 miles of the line underground specifically to address a concern, a primary concern of New Hampshire with respect to aesthetic impacts. That added significantly to the project cost and required us to reduce the size. And that's drawn a lot of support. You know, folks in New Hampshire have applauded that. So I would say in New Hampshire generally, we have very strong support from key elected officials, from the business community, from organized labor, from small businesses, both in northern New Hampshire and in southern New Hampshire. And it's largely as a result of the significant benefits the project delivers to New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, from the groups that you pointed out, I think there may be indeed lots of support, but I think there was also lots of pushback from residents. I mean, every time I've gone up to northern New Hampshire, I see tons of Stop the Northern Pass billboards and bumper stickers. But maybe a lot of those concerns were appeased with the putting the lines underground. I'm not sure. But it sounds like there's still a rocky road ahead here, because the Attorney General today says she's going to take a look at whether there was adequate transparency in this decision. I mean, what do you think the next steps are for this project? Do you have confidence it's going to move forward?
Well, I do. And with respect to the Attorney General's review, I was not aware that she had made that announcement, but we certainly welcome that review. As I said earlier, I think it was always contemplated by Massachusetts law that this would be an open process, and the Attorney General is a key part of that. So we welcome the review. Beyond that, you know, the project is in the final stages of siting. Actually, starting tomorrow, the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee will begin its deliberations with respect to our permit. It is the final permit that we need, a significant permit that we need to move into construction. We have virtually all of our federal permits and our Canadian permits. So this is the key final permit. We expect to receive that by March and to move into construction in April.
Well, William Quinlan is president of Eversource New Hampshire. Thank you so much, Mr. Quinlan. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Meghna. Have a good afternoon.
All right, so let's switch gears here entirely. If you work for a big or even not so big employer, chances are you've been invited to join a workplace wellness program. Over 50 million American workers are covered by such wellness programs these days, and the whole field has exploded in recent years to the point that it's an $8 billion industry. But a new study is raising questions about whether these programs are as effective as we've been led to believe. And joining us to explain is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Meghna.
So your headline about this is striking. Study finds virtually zero benefit from workplace wellness programs?
That's right. Pretty much zero on just about all the incomes that the researchers measured. So no lower health costs, no fewer sick days, no rise in productivity, and not even any extra trips to the gym.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So I'm thinking of all kinds of possible issues here. But first, let me just give me more of the basics of the study. One study, though, and, you know, its findings are counterintuitive, to say the least.
Yes. And one study is only ever one study. But nonetheless, you know, it's just interesting because it just seems to make sense that if your employer's helping you get healthier, like quit smoking or count your steps or get your blood pressure checked, that it should have some measurable effects. That's why bosses are willing to do these programs. But this new study, which was just put out by the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is based here in Cambridge, it used what's often called the gold standard, which is a randomized controlled trial of thousands of employees at the University of Illinois. And so that way it could counteract the self-selection that's likely to happen with many wellness programs.
Oh, yeah, of course. The people who participate in them are likelier to be people who are healthier anyway.
Right. Like, nice to get paid to go to the gym if you go to the gym anyway, right? Right. So this is a great big confounding effect in a lot of these studies, right? So confounder alert, confounder alert. And one thing the researchers were really looking for was what they wanted to find: the causal effects of these wellness programs on health and work outcomes. Here's one of the researchers, David Molitor from the University of Illinois.
And across 39 different outcomes that we looked at, we found kind of zeros and fairly precise zeros on almost all outcomes. We looked at healthcare spending between the treatment and control groups, we found no difference in the healthcare spending, in average healthcare spending in the first year of the program. And that's kind of was maybe our main outcome of interest was the healthcare spending.
Now, Meghna, you could certainly say that it takes a lot more time than 1 year for living a healthier life, right? It's a journey
it's
to wellness.
It's a lifetime.
Yes. But here's the thing that really surprised me. Here's David Molitor again.
And we also found no difference in health behaviors, no difference between treatment and control group and participating in the gym or participating in this popular community running event.
So there were no immediate effects on behavior. I thought that was really important. They found a couple of little effects. People were likelier to say that their employer probably cared about their health, and they were likelier to have a health screening like blood pressure.
Okay, but this is just 1 year again. So, but what about measures like blood pressure or weight, better long-term indicators about whether or not wellness programs have an effect?
Right, so they're still working on those. This was only 1 year of what's going to be a four-year study, and so it needs to have more time. But what made me think it was worth noting was just that these researchers are really agnostic about wellness programs. They really don't have a dog in this fight. So here's David Molitor one last time.
And we're also open-minded regarding the possibility for effects to emerge in the long run when they don't in the short run. So our main hope is that this study provides credible evidence on the impacts of these programs in a space where credible evidence is lacking for kind of how big of an issue workplace wellness is.
So, and that credible evidence is subtext for, like, there are a lot of wellness programs out there that say, hey, we can produce really great effects. We'll have a great effect on your bottom line. And in fact, what this study underscores is that, you know, if they're basing their effects on a group that might have self-selected, then their results are highly questionable.
Okay, so we got like 20 seconds here, Carrie.
Yeah.
I just want to know, though, I mean, there's a basic fact that more wellness is good. And if employees and employers care, it's going to be a good thing.
Right. And that's why it's counterintuitive. And the answer is that there are two kinds of wellness, the kind that's for you, like, hey, here's a gym pass and here's healthy food. That's good. But wellness that's done to you could backfire.
Got it.
So that's the takeaway.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, she is the head of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to her post about workplace wellness programs at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay healthy, Carrie.
Be well.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.